Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The writer Tilar Matseo says the captains of clipper ships in the mid-1800s were the rock stars of their time. They were young and they were truly gutsy because these ships weren't built for safety, they were built for speed. The idea was to race, like quite literally race, from the East Coast down around the continent and back up to the gold rush in California. They would take supplies and then bring back the booty. And these captains were always men, of course, but Tilar Matseo tells the story in her book about the first woman to do this. Her name was Marianne Patton. In 1856, she found herself in charge of one of the fastest of these clippers, Neptune's Car. She was 19 years old and a few months pregnant. Now, her husband Joshua was the captain. She had gone with him on the voyage. The idea was to earn enough money for them to leave the relentless clipper trade and to buy a farm. And at this point in the story, Tilar Matseo says they were close, but not there yet. And the stakes couldn't have been higher.
They're carrying millions of dollars of somebody else's cargo. And if they can survive three, maybe four circumnavigations, they will have enough money to retire from the sea, which is an incredibly dangerous profession, and to build a life and build this farm and have a family. Their whole future is on the line. And then they're coming down the coast of South America, and Joshua is very, very, very sick. And the problem is that Keeler, the first mate, is just a wicked man. He's already had to be put down in the brig. He's already been demoted at this point and stripped of his rank as first mate. And they are coming now into Drake's Passage and around the end of Cape Horn. There is always also, if something happens to her husband, the constant risk of sexual violence. And she's the only woman aboard this ship. So they're coming down, and Joshua is ill. It turns out that he has tuberculosis, and he collapses. Marianne in the captain's quarters looks out through the window. She sees the face contorted with fear and excitement. The eyes meet her own. Something is urgent. She hears the cry, "Captain." Marianne knows Joshua. So she takes the helm along with the second mate. And the problem with the second mate is, though he's a very good sailor, he's not literate, so he can't navigate, which means he can't do what the captain and first mate do. And at the beginning, nobody debates it, because they're in the middle of this terrible storm. They're fighting to survive, but things aren't going very well. The storm is so powerful that they're not making any headway. And down below in the brig, Keeler is drip, drip, drip poison. Mr. Keeler is indignant and vengeful. He has been stirring up the crew against Marianne and against Joshua. He has been saying that the captain's wife, a slip of a girl, is not their master. No woman is his master. He has been saying that command of the ship belongs in right to him as the first mate, that Captain Patton had no right, that Mr. Hare does not know how to do a reckoning, and that without him, they will all be shipwrecked and will perish. He has been pressing the cook and the crew to release his bonds, and he can see, as the storm rages, their resolve softening. So Keeler decides to send her this letter where he makes the demands. He feels confident that if it goes in front of the crew is going to mutiny. What happens is she calls in all hands on deck. She orders that Mr. Keeler be brought to the quarterdeck to listen. Under her oilskin, she has carefully wrapped Joshua's pistol close to her body. She does not think that the crew yet can see how it is swelling. She holds out Mr. Keeler's letter to show these demands and begins to speak. she goes through all of the things that he's done. Betrayed the captain, and he's not keeping watch, not making good time on the sails. All of these things that he's done.
"My husband did not trust Mr. Keeler," she told the crew. "I shall not reinstate him."
And then she says to them, "I am asking you to follow my husband's commands and to let me be the captain."
Then she turned away from the crew to make her way back to the captain's quarters and Joshua. If the crew refused, she would lock herself in the captain's quarter with Joshua and stand guard with the loaded pistol as long as she was able. Then she turns and her back is to the crew, and there is this long moment. We don't know, of course, exactly what Marianne felt and experienced. But that moment must have felt like forever to her, because her entire life and Joshua's life held in the balance. A young woman standing at the bottom of the world, expectant with a baby and a gun at her waist, wondering what is going to happen. And in that moment, she hears a crack that breaks through the silence. And she doesn't know whether that crack is violence or something else about to happen. And then she turns and she sees what has unfolded. The captain of a ship had power of life and death at sea. So this incredibly kind of profound decision that these men are faced with having to make, agreeing that this young woman is going to be the master of them and that they are going to put their destiny in her hands. But what happens afterwards when her story is told is she becomes both a story about why women's suffrage is a conversation that the United States wants to have and that ultimately leads to the 19th Amendment. But she's also part of the conversation in the lead up to the American Civil War about what does it mean in a nation divided to be someone that everybody can agree represents the best of what it means to be an American. That's the reason her story ultimately becomes so beloved in the later part of the 1850s and into the 1860s. She stands in for something, a much, much larger cultural dynamic.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Tilar Matseo is with us to talk about her book. It's called The Sea Captain's Wife. In it, she draws on ship's logs and letters and newspaper reports, but also her own experience as a sailor. Early on in the book, she invokes the image of rough seas, the cold, angry emptiness where you fall and rise in darkness.
This is a deeply personal story for me. I mean, not only because I'm a sailor and also because I happen to grow up in the same little village that Joshua Patton grew up in.
Yeah.
And I come from a long line of people who were merchant sailors or sea captains or lobstermen. And I have never been in seas as terrible as the seas that Marianne Patton was in.
Yeah.
But I have been on the open Pacific in winds that were fortunately not too strong for my boat, but were far, far beyond my own capacity as a sailor, right? There's a saying, which is that, you know, usually the boat is stronger than any of the sailors on it. And there are moments when you just have to trust your boat, right? And I have been terrified. I know what it is to stand there and look at the wave coming and think, I need to make it through this one wave. And after this wave, there will be another wave. And I need to make sure that wave does not hit my boat in a direction that will flip us and drown us, right? Mm-hmm. And the waves just keep coming because the sea is endless. And that was the experience I wanted to give the reader of understanding, like, we don't know what it is to read the newspaper and to wonder whether our families made it somewhere.
Yeah.
Because shipwrecks happened all the time.
Before we get back to the voyage and the ferocity of the sea, you tell the story of the land, as you put it. And you write about this time when the coast of Maine, which is hard to imagine right now, thinking about the coast of Maine now, but you say then it was the center of this prosperous international culture. Give us the setting for this story, because that's an important part of this.
So we're talking about Penobscot Bay,
yeah,
which is basically what we would call mid-coast Maine. Mm. So north of Portland, south of Bar Harbor, right?
Yeah.
And this was the center of shipbuilding. Searsport was a very small, still is a very small little village of a couple of thousand people. But at this moment in time, it has 10% of all of the sea captains in the United States are from Searsport. Right?
That's incredible, by the way. Right. What do you make of that?
It is, well, partly like being a sea captain was an intergenerational thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It was passed from father to son or uncle, right? It ran in families. That's the reason my family has so many of them, is that it ran in families. You took children to sea with you when they were quite young. Boys often went to sea at 10, 11, 12, that would be pretty common to have gone to sea early. So that by the time you're 21, you're a captain,
yeah,
right? So you have this area where it's just, it's an incredibly rich area for exactly the kind of harbors that you need to run these tall sailing ships. Mm. So I grew up, I went to the school in Camden. If you've ever been to Camden, Maine, or if you ever should go, you'll know that the Windjammers still sail out of there.
Right.
These huge, you know, 3, 4, 5-masted schooners. And imagine, you know, what it is to have ships so big that they have 5 masts, right? These are incredibly huge ships. But what everybody wanted was the land, because the 19th century in the United States is really just one big economic history of land speculation. I mean, it's not really so different than the 20th century.
Right. I mean, you say it when the captains of the region sailed, it wasn't because of the sea. It was because of it was the land that called to them, which I think is a really important part of understanding Joshua and this story.
I mean, I say that in the story, you know, the tighter the bottlenecks of commerce, the more valuable the land was, right?
Yeah.
And so that land was incredibly valuable land because it had the ports that allowed you to trade with the whole world. So there was a moment in this moment, right, in the 1850s, where if you mentioned Searsport, Maine, everybody knew where Searsport and Rockland and Penobscot Bay were. It's like saying where Paris or London were.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, if you go to Maine and you drive up, you know, from New Hampshire and you're coming along the highway, if you look over into the roads off into the woods, you will see abandoned stone walls. And those stone walls are all there because really 100 years ago, all of that was settled farmland. Right. It was incredibly prosperous land. And now it's just forests. And now all those huge sea captains' homes are so expensive that nobody can afford to heat them in the winter because nobody has 15 children and servants and, you know, ships. And so, you know, Maine, as we see it now, looks nothing like it would have looked in that time. It was really an incredibly prosperous area. And it ran from basically New York all the way to places like Newfoundland and Labrador even. Right.
Yeah. I think that when you write in the book that it was also the land that called to them, it made me think beyond the idea of land being commerce. I also thought about Joshua and land being the dream. Like, I will work as a captain, and as we'll talk about here in a moment, I'll make my fortune early on, and then I'll have a farm. It sounds like he was thinking of the time when he can get off the sea, not one of those old, you know, sea captain types. But and I wonder if that's part of this story, too, mm-hmm. the idea of it was the farm that he had in mind, not a life on the sea. Is that right?
I think that's right. I don't think and nobody in their right mind wanted a life on the sea.
Right.
It was crowded, yeah, and cold, yeah, and wet and dangerous. Right. I mean, the story of the social mobility, right, that it allowed was this incredible story. A young man from, you know, working middle class background could go to sea and by the time he was 30, be wealthy enough that he could have a farm and he could build himself a sea captain's house and he could look out to the sea and maybe he could, you know, he could probably buy a mill up the river and have things to send.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could make a fortune in a decade. But what he wanted was to be landed gentry, ultimately. What you wanted was a farm and a beautiful wife and beautiful children, you know, running down to the banks of the river. Mm. And the thing about the Wasgig River is that it is also one of those magical places in the world, right? I mean, you know, we talk about places where the veil is thin and where, you know, there is something magical about it. Mm. Well, the Wasgig River is one of those places. It used to be called the Land of the Spirits, right? So when Nathaniel Hawthorne writes about it in The House of Seven Gables, he talks about it as being this kind of haunted land that was considered the home of the spirits. And it is this incredibly beautiful, weirdly, austerely sacred landscape. Yeah. And so for him, you know, he thinks of that as the land of his, that his family lost when his mother died. And so for him to want to have a farm on that river is particularly, I think, emotionally important to him.
Yeah, it's the underlying incentive for the whole story, Joshua and Marianne, to make it back to that part of the world and have a farm.
They want to go home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's another setting we should talk about that's important to the story. Basically, it's the gold rush. When we talk about the voyages of these clippers, where you, as you put it in the book, you turn west to the New World and then follow that line to Tierra del Fuego, past Cape Horn, and then back up the, you know, along the edge of the Pacific. The idea here is the gold rush. Will you talk about this part of the story?
Yeah, so 1850s is the gold rush. It also happens, not coincidentally, to be the era of the clipper ships, yeah, right? And it's a moment, it's maybe a decade, right, where gold has been discovered in California, and suddenly everybody wants to get to California to make their fortune. And, of course, this is a moment in time in which the Panama Canal doesn't yet exist. So the only way to get goods from Boston or New York to California, because there's also no transcontinental railroad yet, right? The only way to get goods there is to go the long way around, which means that you have to go all the way down to the tip of South America, past Tierra del Fuego, and then you have to make that incredibly treacherous passage westward through what's known as Drake's Passage and around Cape Horn. And then you have to come back up the coast of the west coast of South America, up past Mexico to San Francisco in order to get there. And it's months, this journey, yeah, right? And there's a race because the people who can get there the fastest, if you can get sugar and pickaxes to San Francisco before anybody else at the beginning of the season, you can name your price for it. Because the amount of money that the 49ers are making is spectacular. I mean, they're making ridiculous amounts of money finding gold. And then that gold is also being sent back around to the banks in New York, right? So there's this trade of, on the, you know, one direction is goods to fuel the gold rush, and then gold coming back the other way around. So, yeah, so that's, I mean, there's an old saying that we all know about the people who got rich in the gold rush were not the people who mined for gold or panned for gold, but the people who sold pickaxes. And that is really the nut of the story. That is the economic global commercial impetus for why young men like Joshua are being sent around the bottom of the world in races against each other.
You write about sea captains being these celebrated figures. I think you've described them kind of like rock stars in some way. What was the skill? What was the gift? I mean, courage, I suppose, for sure. But you had to be good at it. What made you good at it? And you had to be. Most of these guys were really young, at least for these clipper ships captains.
Yeah, they were almost all. I mean, sometimes you might get a captain in his 40s, right? Somebody who just couldn't make themselves give up on the money,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But most of them were in their 20s or early 30s.
Wow.
So this was very much a young man's thing. And they were incredible celebrities, the clippers, those who were sailing, especially the extreme clippers. And the thing about extreme clippers is that they were built for speed, but not for safety.
Right.
They are incredibly overpowered. So part of it was you had to have immense physical courage, because in order to sail a clipper ship is, you know, fast, you had to be constantly vigilant to pushing the machinery of the sails as fast as you could, which meant that you were always sailing at the brink of disaster. And that also meant that you had to be a pretty good leader, because you had to convince a group of men who were not going to make a fortune that it was somehow in their best interests to risk their lives 24/7, right? So You had to be a really, really charismatic and powerful and often, you know, often quite violent. You know, you had to be authoritarian. You couldn't allow the crew to ever let up. And you had to be willing to constantly live with danger. And then, you know, there were really two other things about it, I think. One of them was just the technical ability to understand how you maximize the sail power of that vessel without capsizing it and destroying it. And then the other part of it was the navigation. So primarily what a sea captain did, and this was Marianne's gift in the end, was celestial navigation and being able to figure out how, without GPS and without electronics, you knew where in the world you were and knew where you were going so you could get there as quickly as possible. A sextant and a watch, and you can figure out exactly where in the world you are, is kind of a mind-blowing concept.
Well, there's this great scene, which we'll get to a little bit later, where the crew describe Marianne in the midst of this. They've allowed her to be captain. They're in the intensity of this gale, or just past it. She is down below in the captain's headquarters, doing the equations, doing the dead reckoning. It's a great scene. How gifted she might have been at navigation really comes through. I think at that moment.
I think that's why the crew acclaim her captain.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they were old. They were seamen and they understood that their lives were at stake. And what they understood is that she was an incredibly gifted mariner. And, you know, there's that wonderful passage. I try not to quote other historians a lot, but there's that one quote that I just thought was so apropos, where somebody says, you know, look, in an era of great sea captains, you know, and her husband was generally accounted to be one of the great sea captains of that decade, right? I mean, he ran an extreme clipper. He was the master of the extreme clipper. He was a great sailor. That what they say is that, you know, there might have been a handful of captains who could have done what Marianne did. And she had done it without having been to sea. She'd only been on one circumnavigation by the time she took the helm. So there was this way in which even in that moment in time, she was recognized as being just an exceptional sailor.
Yeah.
So that Joshua says about her, if she had been a man, she might have been of use, right?
Yeah. Tilar Matseo. We're talking about her new book. It's called The Sea Captain's Wife, a true story of mutiny, love, and adventure at the bottom of the world. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Tilar Matseo's new book. It's the story of Marianne Patton. In 1856, she set sail with her husband Joshua, the captain of a clipper ship called Neptune's Car. Matseo says clipper captains were the rock stars of the time. They were well paid, but it was dangerous work, and their voyages were basically races with other ships that were covered by newspapers and wagered on by the public. Marianne was 19 years old and pregnant. She had come with Joshua because they were in love and they wanted to escape the high-stakes clipper trade to buy a farm. When Joshua broke down from tuberculosis, Marianne took command and convinced the crew to follow her. She navigated the ship through a relentless gale across Drake's Passage and brought it safely to San Francisco. The book is called The Sea Captain's Wife. Let's talk about where she comes from, Marianne. I'm so glad there's a daguerreotype of her. It was taken in, I think, 1857. You describe her as light and small, as ethereal, extraordinarily pretty. Talk a little bit about her early life. Her brothers worked as caulkers. It seemed like a working class family. So what was expected of, what did she expect for her life, I guess, in those early days?
Yeah, so she's not only working class, but a deeply impoverished recent immigrant family to the north end of Boston, which at that point is essentially a maritime red light district. And her brothers all have very, very working class jobs. Her father is a seaman, which is the lowest rank of a sailor, and he never rises above the rank of seaman. So what we don't know is whether her father was just simply not very good at it, or whether he was what was then known as unsteady, which probably meant drink, right?
Yeah.
And he was away for large portions of the time. Her mother probably either worked as a servant in other people's homes, or more likely probably took in laundry. That's usually what people in her class position did. They lived in tenement housing. And what was expected of Mary Ann was not that she would go to school. It was expected that she would go to work by the time she was, I don't know, 12, 10, 11, 12, that she would support the family by with her labor, maybe would go later and work in a factory, maybe get married. You know, she does, in fact, get married when she's 15.
Yeah.
So she marries Joshua when she's an incredibly young woman. She's not yet 16 when she marries Joshua.
You write about their sort of courtship, which would have followed the, you know, the strictures and the particular traditions. Joshua probably, you know, had to ask Mr. or Mrs. Brown's permission to, you know, sit with his daughter in the parlor or whatever it was. And they get married. Joshua, as you say in the book, just shy of his 26th birthday. She's not quite 16. But here's the kind of gut-wrenching story. Her father, George Brown, on their wedding day, you say the day he gave away his 15-year-old daughter in marriage, he probably knew he had tuberculosis.
Yeah, I think her father was already dying by then. I mean, and tuberculosis was known as the White Plague.
Yeah.
And in Britain and in North America, it killed an entire generation, killed several generations, right? I mean, really, for the better part of the 19th century, it was this, it was just this terrible, terrible disease that killed a huge percentage of the population. And it was a particularly cruel disease because it tended to kill most effectively young people. So kind of like the great flu pandemics of the early 20th century that we hear about. It was a disease that for whatever reason struck down young people with particular ferocity. And it was something that if you were living in the small confined spaces of a ship, you were very, very likely to get because it was highly contagious. So it tore through shipping communities. And her father probably got it at sea. And it's likely that when Joshua and Mary Ann were home between their first and second circumnavigation, they went to go see her family. Her father would have been, by that point, very ill. I mean, he's dead before they reached San Francisco. And it's likely, although he could have got it from other places, but the most likely place that Joshua contracts tuberculosis himself is ultimately from her father.
Yeah. So before we get to the voyage, sort of the center part of the story, they go on a voyage together before this. It's kind of an apprenticeship kind of voyage. Why does she go with him? Talk about that. Was that – how extraordinary was that for her, this young, you know, when they're married, barely 16-year-old young woman going along with her husband?
It wasn't unheard of.
Yeah.
I mean, there were other women who did it. So she is not the only or the first woman to go as a sea captain's wife, but it was not remotely typical. It was an extraordinary decision to have made. I mean, in part because going to sea as a sea captain's wife, especially on a cargo run, meant that she was for, I mean, several years, the only woman aboard a ship.
Yeah.
And the rules were such that when she was on that ship, she was not allowed to talk to the crew. She was allowed to talk to her husband, the first mate, and to a very, very select group of people. Mm. It would have been just crushingly boring.
And lonely, right?
Incredibly lonely, incredibly isolated, boring, because, you know, other than reading and sewing, and if you've ever tried reading and sewing in heavy weather, it's you're not going to do that for very long, right? I mean, that's what she would have done in very, very cramped spaces. So why any woman would want to do this, right, is most women didn't. Most women stayed at home and ran their households and their families.
But she does it because she and Joshua are madly in love with each other. They are two young people who want nothing more than to build a farm and have a family. Like, that is the thing they want, is to be together. And so he does start sailing, and he goes away the first time when he's doing the passenger ship runs across the Atlantic to Liverpool.
Right.
And she finds that also so lonely and heartbreaking that they decide they can't bear to be separated. So when he goes on the first circumnavigation, he agrees to take less of a contract on the understanding that his wife can come. And that is how she learns how to sail, is on that first multi-year circumnavigation.
I'm imagining Marianne then confined to the space on the ship. And this is maybe, I guess, this is when she starts to study Joshua's navigation manuals. She starts to learn celestial navigation. I'm guessing she's observing how decisions are made, how things are shifting. And talk about her learning, because this seemed really critical to her. She learns a lot on this voyage.
Yeah. I mean, on the first circumnavigation, they're gone several years, right? So they're at sea several years. And as you say, she has nothing else to do. You know, if you've ever been in heavy weather, you know that the easiest way to get seasick is to do something like focus on needlework or read a book. I mean, that's a guaranteed recipe for seasickness. The best way not to get seasick is to keep your eyes on the horizon, right? So she would have done that. I mean, she would have done what everybody does at sea, which is you keep your eye on the horizon so that you don't get motion sickness. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that at sea, keeping your eye on the horizon means watching the wind and the waves and the sails and the stars, right? And that is exactly what she does on that first circumnavigation. I mean, we think that Neptune's car had maybe 70 different sails, and she learned the ropes. And because she was spending her time focusing on the horizon and the seas and the stars and the waves and the wind, that is where she would have begun learning celestial navigation.
So they go on this first circumnavigation, as you say. Set us up for the second one. This is when Joshua takes command of the Clipper, Neptune's car. Talk about what the idea here is. The owners of the ship, they wanted this to be a race, basically. So set that up for us.
Yeah, so the owners are, as I've said before, I mean, they're quite exploitative, yeah. Right? I mean, these guys are making a huge amount of money by pitting a group of young men against each other to take these incredible risks. And one of the ways that they pit the young men against each other is by these bets, some of them more formal than others. I mean, you know, there's also gentlemen's bets about, you know, no, I'm a better captain than you, I'll bet you, right? I mean, that also happened. I mean, I say in the book, it's a little bit like fantasy football.
Right, exactly, right? Like, right.
People did. They went down and they had their teams. I'm like, oh, no, you know, Neptune's car is, you know, going to beat Snow Squall,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so there was gambling down at the docks. These were things that were for fun, people participated in, right? Also not for fun for the captains, because if you won, there was a considerable bonus, mm-hmm. right? If you could make it from New York or Boston to San Francisco in 100 days or less, that was considered international news and worth $2,000, right? Which was, I don't know, $150,000 or so today. So, you know, a pretty significant purse. So it was this way of basically egging on a group of young men who were, you know, driving what were the fastest race cars of their era mm-hmm. through the most dangerous places in the world, encouraging them to keep their focus on winning. It wasn't just about making what was known as your competence, which was the amount of money that you needed to retire for the rest of your life. But it was about also making it so that, you know, your ego was wound up in being the best sea captain. Mm. So this is what happens. And so they're in this four-way race. And the day before they're meant to leave, Joshua and Marianne had a trusted first mate who had made the first circumnavigation with them.
Right.
And as they're completing the loading of the ship, he falls through an open hatch and doesn't realize that one of the hatches is open, and he falls through it and he breaks his leg.
Yeah.
So he's out, and Joshua goes to the ship's owner and he tries to cancel the race. He's like, I think we need to delay until I can find a first mate. Like, I have to be able to trust my first mate.
And the ship's owner refuses and says, no, you're going to sail tomorrow. I'll find you a first mate. And the only first mate that you can find at the last minute on the docks is Keeler.
Yeah.
And so Keeler gets brought in at that moment.
Wait, he's 20 years old. I find that remarkable. You describe him as hot-headed, violent, and duplicitous. He's a 20-year-old from Philadelphia.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, they're all young men, right? I mean, yeah, most young men are sea captains by the time they're 21 or 22. So Keeler is probably himself not very far away from Amy's first mate. The next promotion for Keeler is to be captain.
So they set sail. I think it's, we should say, as you point out in the book, that Marianne doesn't have any of these grand ambitions to be a captain. I think, as you put it in the book, she had nothing of the rebel in her. She didn't expect to wear the pants, the bloomers. Say something about that, if you would.
Yeah, she was not, in a moment of suffragettes, she was not a suffragette.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, I love a spunky gal as much as the next woman, right? But Mary Ann was a woman of her time. She was not our idea, if I'm allowed to say this, of a quote-unquote badass, right? Like, she wasn't. That's not how she understood her or how her culture understood her achievement, which was internationally celebrated. Mm. She believed that being a wife was what she wanted to do. She wanted to be a good wife and a good mother. She was quietly religious. She didn't have any pretensions of wearing the pants or any idea that she was going to do anything other than what she believed was her role. Mm. She loved her husband and wanted to support her husband. She didn't set out to be an international celebrity.
Yeah.
So instead, what she does is she finds herself through circumstance in a moment where she has to fight to save her family and any chance of her family having a future. And when that happens, you know, she fights with this kind of physical courage and intensity and devotion and loyalty that it was universally sort of understood to have been an extraordinary story. Mm. You know, this was a woman who faced with nothing but bad choices, fought as hard as she could for the people she loved. And she did what she thought of as her duty.
Tilar Matseo, her book is The Sea Captain's Wife, a true story of mutiny, love, and adventure at the bottom of the world. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Tilar Matseo. We're talking about her new book, The Sea Captain's Wife. So early on, she starts to see how things are unfolding with Keeler. And it so happens that he's caught sleeping on watch. Now, okay, you fall asleep on watch. But talk about the meaning of that and how important this moment is for a first mate to fall asleep on watch.
First mate does not fall asleep on watch.
Yeah.
It's like that is not done. Because in that moment, the first mate is acting captain, right? So the first mate and the captain are basically sharing the responsibility of captain. The first mate is the person who, when the captain is sleeping, because the captain has to sleep sometimes, is in charge of the ship. So for a first mate or a captain to have fallen asleep on duty is a dereliction of duty of the first order, right? Because what he has done in that moment is not only has he lost them time in a race, and time is money in a clipper ship trade, but more importantly, he has put all of their lives physically in danger.
And what happens?
So he's found doing this. You know, he and Joshua have a series of problems in the beginning where Keeler also talks back to the captain, you know, gives him lip service. They've already nearly come to blows over it before this happens. And he's caught not once but twice sleeping on watch. The second time, Joshua awakes and he realizes that something doesn't feel right about how the boat is sailing. So he gets up and he realizes that the first mate is not on the quarterdeck. And he goes looking for him, and he finds him stretched out in a cot, asleep in the cook's quarter. So it's not just that he's fallen asleep on the deck, right? It's that he's gone downstairs, you know, found himself a place to cuddle up by the fire and, like, went to bed, right? So at this point, he and Joshua have a quite violent argument, you know, where the point where he is basically marched at gunpoint down into the brig and put into leg irons, which means that Joshua essentially has to be captain 24/7.
Right.
And he's sick. He's contracted tuberculosis. He manages this for more than a week in the middle of a storm as they're coming through, you know, down the coast to South America into the Strait of Lemaire. And at that point, Joshua is so exhausted and so sick that he collapses unconscious on deck.
You write about how he can feel his force draining. There's no fight left. He gives in. What happens once he becomes unconscious? Like, what is the sense and the awareness of the crew? Like, and what they realize, all of them, of course, Marianne included, that is the dilemma before them.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know exactly how many people there were on the circumnavigation. There are probably 24 members of crew with them. And that's a small enough number that they all would have known what happened, right? Everybody knew that the captain had collapsed. Mm. The logical thing to do if your family's future didn't depend on it, and if your duty wasn't to the ship's owners to get that cargo to San Francisco, would have been to have turned around and have gone back to Buenos Aires. The problem was that if you turned around and did that, the minute you arrived, all of your crew were going to disappear and get on other ships, and you were going to be stranded. And then the fees, the port fees, would destroy you. So Marianne and Joshua knew that turning back meant that they would be financially destroyed, and that there would be no farm on the banks of the West Gig River, right? That would be the end of it. And that she would be stuck there alone, that Joshua would have no medical help, you know, in that area of South America, and that she would not have had, as a woman, the captain's wife, if he were unconscious, she would not even have had the ability on land to have sold the cargo to try to recoup any of the losses. So in that moment, Marianne decides that turning back cannot happen, that they have to press forward. And part of what Keeler is trying to persuade everybody to do is to turn tail and run back, because there's no incentive for the crew to risk their lives. I mean, there is a real conflict between the captain and the crew.
Yeah. That gets us back to the story where we began. Marianne's speech, which you write about in the book as, we're not exactly sure what she said. It wasn't really recorded, but as you put it in the book, it must have been one hell of a speech. So take us back to this moment where she's acknowledging what is happening. She's making her case, and finish the story that you started at the beginning.
I mean, exactly. We don't know exactly the words. We only know what the men who were on the crew later told different journalists. So everything that we have is third-person reporting and not first-person reporting. But it went something very much like this, according to those third-person reports in the newspapers. Marianne calls the all hands on deck, and she says, Keeler has sent me this letter, and he demands to be captain. And you know that my husband, the captain, has a brain fever and is incapacitated. And you know that we're in this terrible storm. And she says, look, Keeler is asking to be reinstated as captain. And I can't do that. My husband put him in the brig for these reasons. This is all of the things that he did to risk all of our lives. This is the reason you can't trust him. He can't do it. And my husband demoted him. And I'm not going to re-promote him. I am going to follow my husband's orders, and I'm asking you to follow my husband's orders. Because after all, she does remind them, my husband still isn't dead, right? He still might wake up and be okay, in which case everybody is going to have to account for justice when we get to San Francisco. So she has Joshua's pistol wrapped around her waist, and she just asks the crew, she says, please don't mutiny. I ask you to let me be the captain until my husband can return to the quarterdeck. And so she leaves them to make their decision, and she doesn't have any idea whether they're going to mutiny or not. I mean, at some level, why would they not mutiny? Mr. Keeler is a horrible man, but he's a very good sailor. And, you know, he has a point. I mean, to some extent, this is his right under maritime law. So she turns, and as she turns, she pauses, and all of a sudden she hears this crack that splits the air. This is how the crew described it later. And, you know, her heart stops, right? Because she doesn't know, like, are they coming for her? What's happening, right? And she turns around and realizes that the crack is the entire crew spontaneously applauding. And the men talk about this later. They say, nobody meant it. Nobody planned it. We just found ourselves suddenly applauding. And then they begin calling out, Captain Patton, Captain Patton, right? Cheering for Captain Patton. And it takes her another moment to realize that they're talking about her, that they're not talking about Joshua. And in that moment, she's the first woman in history to be acclaimed captain of a merchant ship. And it should be this moment of great triumph, except that what has to come next is they still have to survive a terrible, terrible gale and another 18 days that will ultimately blow them off course almost as far as Antarctica.
We'll let readers read that part of the book. But would you just say how she comes up with a plan to, I mean, yes, she had studied circumnavigation in that first voyage with her husband. She's learned all of this stuff, but she must have been a natural, because she comes up with this plan to let the weather take them straight into the Southern Ocean, which is really risky. You don't need to get into all of the details, but it works. It sounds a little risky, but really brilliant.
She was an absolute. I don't think there's any doubt that she was one of those incredibly gifted mariners,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
She's also, you know, a woman of a capacious intelligence. I mean, that was one of the things her husband said about her, is that she was an incredibly intelligent woman who had never been given a scope for that intelligence until this moment. And ultimately, yes, what she decides is that after days of trying to fight this storm, she realizes that the ship is going to fall apart from the force of the winds and the waves. Mm. And she does the only thing that is left to her to do, which is to try to find the outer edge of the storm, because storms are circular, right? Mm. They run in circular patterns. Mm. To find the outer edge of the cyclonic system and let the storm blow you out of this storm system. But in Drake's passage, that meant blowing you right into the Great Southern Ocean and into the icebergs off the coast of Antarctica.
You write this in an epilogue for the book. If this is where the Patton story ends, it is also where my story begins. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I didn't begin writing this book because Joshua Patton was from the same small fishing village in Maine that I grew up in, where my family, his family, had been sea captains. So, I mean, part of it is, I mean, that is just the coincidence,
yeah,
that, you know, Marianne's story is also, you know, my family's story. And what I wanted to do in writing the book was to tell the story as one Mainer would tell it to another Mainer if we were talking amongst ourselves. But it's not just because, I mean, the last sentence of the book, which I think it's okay to give away, you know, is to also say that my story and Marianne and Joshua's story is also all of our stories. You know, so many of us had families who came over in steerage, whether they came over willingly or unwillingly, and that unless all we ever want are the stories of presidents and princes and, you know, the sea captain's owners, we have to accept that our stories are sometimes we're only going to almost know what the Marianne Pattons of the world said. And we have to be comfortable with the idea that the stories of working class and middle class and average people
are important and are worth telling, and that unless we imagine them as the nation builders, then their stories will disappear. You know, this is a story about the small and nearly forgotten lives of two people that are just as big and wide as the entire American story, right? It's the story of what average people who, out of, you know, love and loyalty and faith in a, you know, in a future, are capable of doing when they have no good choices left.
Tilar Matseo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tilar Matseo. Her book is called The Sea Captain's Wife, a true story of mutiny, love, and adventure at the bottom of the world. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.